This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis, and today we're going to throw some things away. I just made a coffee, added a sugar, and I'm going to toss that packet away. And you know what? This stupid pen isn't working either. Ugh. That needs to go in the trash. And you know what? I think it's time to upgrade my phone. Time to throw that away, too. Now, when you do those things with the sugar packet, the pen, the smartphone, that's the end of it, right? You probably assume all the time that things just go away. But you know what?
There's no such place as away.
Well, Richard Lute, Director of Environmental Affairs at Interior Removal Specialist in Southgate, disposes of waste materials from building projects, and he is under no illusions about our trash disappearing.
Your whole life, you're told you buy it, you use it, you throw it away. And the waste industry and government has done a phenomenal job teaching us that we don't have to think about our waste. Well, there's no such place as away. Everything has to go someplace. There is an end-of-life cost to everything.
Today on Greater LA, we're kicking off a series on waste. Not so much where it's going. I'm guessing you've probably heard about landfills and floating islands of plastic in the ocean. You know it's an ugly mess, but what can you do about it? So for the next few weeks, we're going to look at a lot of ways people here in LA and throughout Southern California are getting creative about reducing, recycling, and avoiding waste. The name of the series, not surprising, Wasted. And it's reported by KCRW's own Francis Anderton at our design and architecture desk. Hi, Francis.
Hi, Steve.
And KCRW's Kaylee Wells, who's in with us as well. Hi, Kaylee.
Hey, Steve.
So no such place as away is a fairly abstract concept, it seems.
And yet, Steve, this was a phrase that we heard over and over again as we talked to various people in the world of waste. This is the notion that we have to consider the end of life of products because our resources are finite and everything has an impact when you throw it away. And when I say we, I mean us, all of us, the so-called consumer, and also designers, manufacturers, CFOs, everyone involved in the production of goods. Now, just to add to that, this series that we've been working on is actually got sponsorship from the California Arts Council. Arts, I emphasize. So it's specifically focused on how things are created and some of the really ingenious thinking that's going on in this state with regards to the dirty issue of waste.
So, Francis, did you find some cool ideas?
Many, Steve. In fact, we barely even scratched the surface of cool ideas. But among those that we'll be talking about over the coming weeks, think, for example, very gee whiz tech solutions like 3D printed buildings that are designed to preempt building construction waste, or plants whose roots are being genetically modified by scientists at the Salk Institute near San Diego in order to suck in more carbon. We also heard about low-tech ideas like, wait for it, Steve, I know you'll be enthusiastic about this one, compost toilets that are now installed in a very large municipal building. We met the fixers, this world of fixers out there who've taken on the tech giants. And I should say that's a very interesting theme because one of our biggest waste issues right now is electronic or e-waste. That's only going to get bigger, I might add, with the advent of more and more electric cars and solar panels. One of our favorite stories, in fact, was one of our e-waste stories when we met the team at Homeboy Electronics Recycling. And that's where both products and people get a second chance. Just hear a clip from Operations Supervisor XCAM.
We find, well, stuff that I deem personally like still very valuable that companies are just getting rid of.
But what we kept coming back to is that sometimes the solutions don't necessarily involve clever tech. Sometimes it might be a change in our behavior. And with that, I want to bring in Kaylee because she explored one of the more extreme examples of that.
Yeah, I'd say it's probably the lowest tech solution that we found. I met a few local people that are part of this worldwide growing movement that is called Buy Nothing. There's thousands of neighborhood groups across the world offering up or asking for free stuff from complete strangers in an attempt to save a little money, a little space, but also save a lot of waste from winding up in the landfill. One of those members is Amelie Gustafsson, who lives in Culver City.
I have, you know, put up basically everything you can think of. Anything from baby clothes to lots of kitchen stuff to a dresser to a dildo. Like, you know, there's just everything.
So a lot of these people thinking about waste argue for an approach that reduces the reliance on new resources. So meaning that whatever you use has a reuse, or maybe it can biodegrade. This approach is part of a greater concept called closing the loop. But as you heard with Amelie, one of the Buy Nothing folks, some of our reports also led us to the conclusion that we need to change our mindset around consumption, obsolescence, and durability of goods as much as the materials themselves.
Those sound interesting, Kaylee, but kind of small solutions. What about policy efforts, like statewide efforts? Aren't those essential?
They are totally essential. And yes, there are efforts at sort of a state level to manage waste. One of them has been introduced by State Senator Ben Allen. His bill is all about reducing plastic waste by making it more decomposable, biodegradable, so it's not sitting in the landfill for years. Then there's Assemblymember Susan Eggman. She's all about the Right to Repair bill, which the whole goal of that is to mandate companies to design products so that they are repairable, so we're not stuck having to buy new stuff.
When we purchase something, is it ours or do we just rent it? Because if it is ours, then we should have the right to repair that.
So yeah, we are going to be talking about those policy goals. We're also going to be talking about smart individuals and some clever solutions that they're thinking up. But we also, and my personal favorite, are going to be touching on what, Steve, you can do if you don't want to live in a world of trash.
Well, all of us, right? I mean, what you can perhaps do to be a part of the solution, right?
Exactly.
And one of the things that everyone can really think about is just where they deposit their trash. So we spoke with a man named Dan Leaf. He's managing editor at Resource Recycling Magazine. And this is what he had to say about how Californians are approaching waste.
One of the biggest things that I've heard coming out of California is that people are too excited to do the right thing.
So what he's referring to, Steve, is what you put into your different bins. For example, most plastic bags these days are no longer being recycled, so don't put them in the blue bin. Try and figure out which bin your old pizza boxes should go in. And by the way, it gets confusing because it varies from city to city.
Yeah, I mean, it seems so complicated these days. I mean, like the rules have changed. And I think, Francis, that has to do with the fact that China no longer takes any of our recycling, right? Or at least most of the recycling they don't take anymore.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Steve. It is true. China used to take a lot of our trash and recycling waste, and that has changed. And what it means is that we here in LA and throughout the state have ended up with huge amounts of plastic and other trash that is going into our landfills. Plastics, especially disposable plastics, are a huge, huge problem. And that takes us right to our first story, which is about plastic.
It is. And to start, we got to start back at the early days of plastic. No one even worried where it went. So in 1960, there were less than 400,000 tons of plastic that went into the U.S. landfills. Fast forward to 2018, and 27 million tons ended up in landfills. Less than 10% of it was recycled. And as we all know, plastic soils our oceans, it poisons our fish and ourselves. And many designers and policymakers and advocates, they're all trying to figure out how to reduce it. Some want to get rid of it altogether. Others want it to be biodegradable. Some say the solution is to stop throwing away plastic goods and instead make them more durable.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
Plastics. Hey, Francis, that's from the movie The Graduate, right?
That's right, Kaylee. What a brilliant movie, by the way. And when the movie The Graduate was released in 1967, plastics meant progress. It was really a miracle material.
You could make hygienic medical products, synthetic fabrics, and endless throwaway goods. Just listen to this promo for PVC plastic bags.
Film or sheet can be heat welded to form bags. And these bags can stand out in open fields. Themselves and their contents safe against all weather.
And then let's talk about toys.
Barbie Dreamhouse!
Barbie's ultimate dream house!
Live! the biggest, fanciest, plasticiest toy of all.
Barbie Dreamhouse!
Barbie Dreamhouse Glam Convertible and other dolls each sold separately, batteries not included.
Now, what if you could take this giant plastic dream house and make it without plastic?
It's a 27-pound toy, 96% of which is plastic. By removing the plastic, I would have the most immediate impact to make the greatest change to the kind of toys we're providing to parents around the world.
Charlie Hodges is a product designer. He recently graduated from Arts Center College of Design in Pasadena. And while there, he took a studio that was sponsored by Mattel. The toy makers asked students to reimagine Barbie's dream house.
So I knew that we needed to definitely depart from the idea of a mega mansion with elevators and pony dens and swimming pools.
So Charlie decided to create a playhouse that was actually nothing like the pink house aimed at little girls. He called it Archimelia, or the House of a Thousand Stories.
I suppose I describe it as the combination of Origami and Transformers with a Where's Waldo dollhouse.
You can see his toy house online. It looks like a box with multiple fold-out sets made of paper and cardboard that can be arranged and rearranged, kind of like stage sets.
Which, I should say, came quite naturally to Charlie Hodges, and that's because before becoming a designer, he was a professional dancer.
So anyway, I want to get back to that plastic.
Oh yes, the plastic. To go about getting rid of plastic, he had to learn first about how it was used. So he did something that's called a life cycle analysis.
That's where you reverse engineer any product to track what's gone into making it.
That's exactly it, and it's quite a fascinating process. So Charlie bought a dream house. He assembled it.
Then I disassembled it to organize by material. And if you burn plastic, various smells or colors or temperatures can indicate what type of plastic it is. So I was able to deduce what were kind of the five main plastics that were used in the making of the toy house and then reverse engineer it. And from it, I learned that there were about seven gases, five plastics, eight metals, four minerals, two elements, and three types of paper that were used for this 27-pound toy that was more or less designed to end up in a landfill.
Armed with this information, Charlie Hodges presented his findings to visiting representatives from Mattel.
I did the guilt trip version, where I said something like, you know, 1.3 million trees are required to offset the CO2 released from the production of one house, and you're producing X many houses a year. And I don't think anybody wants to hear that, especially if, even in a school setting, I am the person hired to fix a problem. No client wants to be told how bad they are.
So it sounds like that guilt trip method didn't go so great.
I think that Charlie learned that presenting in this way wasn't always the most helpful way. And next time, he says that he presented his analysis of plastics a little bit more diplomatically and even piqued Mattel's interest. There was some talk of a meeting with higher-ups that wound up not happening. So Charlie forged ahead on his own. He established his company, Archimelia, and he built a limited edition of his toy house, around 350 of them, and he's selling them online.
But you're probably wondering about that plastic. Was he able to get rid of all of it?
So that's, I think, been the biggest challenge, honestly, to be able to get rid of plastic inside of a toy. Some of the hurdles are like durability.
He ended up making his house out of paper, board, eco-friendly inks, and he did admit that there was a tiny plastic element, little tape tabs that hold the strong paper boards together.
By the way, we reached out to Mattel to hear their take on this story, but we didn't hear back. Interestingly, though, they have their own history to draw from. Barbie's first dream house was made of, wait for it, fold-out cardboard.
Here it is, Barbie's dream house. The whole house and everything in it folds up into its own sturdy carrying case.
Love it. So there's other companies that are also thinking about the plastic content in their products. Let's talk about Newell Brands. This is a company that makes hundreds of household goods, from baby strollers to Sharpie pens. Nate Young is their Senior Vice President for Design and Innovation. He's an alumnus of Art Center College of Design, and he also taps students there for alternatives to plastics. But at the end of the day, he told us, it is hard for companies to make the switch.
This is the tougher one because, as you know, the consumers right now are pretty sensitive to recycling and green, but they're pretty fickle in that if it costs much more, they're not sure if they would buy it.
So plastic means cheap, and cheap means throwaway. But it's throwaway that we should be concerned with.
And that is exactly the view of Odile Madden.
It seems to me that if we valued plastic objects more, we wouldn't want to throw them away.
Odile is a senior scientist for modern materials research at the Getty Conservation Institute. And there she works on preserving plastics in artworks. And she recalls that there was a time when plastics were simply not thrown away.
Plastics really flourish during World War II, which was a time when people were stingier with things. We knew the value of something because there was a scarcity to it. So people didn't throw things away. So advertising for plastics had to overcome this habit. And so there are advertisements that encourage, say, a housewife in a beautiful dress who's just throwing up plates into the air because housework is finished. Why wash a dish?
So what she's saying is the real problem we've created isn't the plastic itself, but its disposability.
We see lots of biodegradable plastics, so technological solutions that presume the plastic needs to go away. What that doesn't address is that the plastic is in the wrong place. It shouldn't be in the ocean. It shouldn't be in our storm drains. It shouldn't be littering our sidewalks or our beaches. And that's an administrative question, a political question, a cultural question. So I think one thing that's not being discussed is the idea of how we choose to use plastic. Because plastic's not evil. It's just stuff. And it's stuff we invented and stuff we choose how to use.
And that means plastic should be more durable. But it's not the main approach that we hear to dealing with plastic waste.
That's right, because most of the solutions try and make plastic a material that decomposes.
Which, by the way, also sounds like a cool idea, but it rarely happens. Because even if you have a plastic that can decompose, you need all these perfect conditions, and the landfill is not one of them.
Nonetheless, State Senator Ben Allen has been fighting very hard to pass a bill which would require that all single-use plastics sold in California should be recyclable or compostable by 2032.
What we're asking is the producers, the folks who actually have control over the product, to take some responsibility over the end use of that product. Are your products being produced with a mind toward a circular economy, with a mind toward recyclability, or are they being produced to go straight into the landfill?
So as you heard, making manufacturers and designers responsible is key. Because currently, it's us that pays the cost, mostly, of plastic waste management.
In the meantime, though, what if we considered Odile's point that we heard, that we would actually do better to make plastic durable, not just more easily disposable?
Well, I asked State Senator Ben Allen about that, and he said it's not out of the question.
I love that idea. It would certainly involve a culture shift. And right now there is a market that is so based on the idea that plastic is cheap and that it is disposable. But look, if we get our bill through and then the true cost of single-use plastic starts to be built in to these products, I think it would shift us toward the type of cultural mindset that she's talking about.
And we will look at many different ways in which Californians are shifting the cultural mindset in the coming weeks.
As we talk to people working on neat solutions to the dirty problem of waste.
For KCRW, I'm Frances Anderton.
And I'm Kaylee Wells. Next week, we'll check in with one building experimenting with a provocative solution to human waste.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. And now to Orange County. In just a few short weeks of this new year, there's already been a lot of grief, unfortunately. And in OC, a lot of folks are remembering Sandra Hutchins, the former Orange County sheriff, the first female OC sheriff who recently died after a long battle with cancer. We're here to reflect on her mark in history for this week's KCRW Orange County Line is LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
She'd been there for a while, obviously. took over after some turbulent times in the sheriff's department as well. But a lot of folks remember her as a trailblazer, as I just mentioned, becoming the first ever female sheriff. Tell us about her life and legacy. How did she get to where she got?
She got there because her predecessor, Mike Corona, went to federal prison for committing a felony of witness tampering. So before that, Sandra had worked at the Sheriff's Department in Los Angeles County, moved up the ranks, and started the lower ranks, became a commander, captain, chief, all the way, then retired. She retired out to, her husband's also in law enforcement. She thought, she would be able to spend her years in retirement, but after the whole Mike Corona fiasco, the supervisors, the Orange County supervisors at the time, they wanted somebody from the outside to try to reform the sheriff's department. So she applied for it. She was told to by her friends to do it, and the board of supervisors voted her in on a 3-2 vote. But for the most part, everybody at the time was happy with the decision.
So she went from LA County to OC. Was there a lot of culture shock for her when she went south?
Well, when you come into a department that was run by a felon and has to deal with the aftermath, yeah. And not only that, you had a lot of Corona's cronies, the cronies, so to speak, who were still there. So she started firing people. She started pushing people out. She started bringing in other LA sheriffs, deputies or alumni to try to reform the department. And it worked. At first it definitely worked. And a lot of what Corona had left behind, she was able to create a department that, if not necessarily the greatest or the best in the United States, at least one that wasn't like the past.
All right. So there she was, change agent at the OC Sheriff's Department after her predecessor went to prison. What was the department like when she took over? I mean, like you said, she got rid of some folks. She tried to clean house. I mean, was she trying to put people in, sort of her own image?
Well, she was trying to create a department that wasn't dirty. I mean, you have to remember, it was a national embarrassment what Corona had left behind, and it reflected so much on Orange County. And so that's what Sandra tried to do. And it worked. It worked for a couple of years. But of course, at the last couple of years of her career, she ended up retiring, and she had to deal with the fallout of the so-called OC snitch scandal, where jailhouse deputies were getting inmates or, informants to procure illegal confessions from other inmates as well. So even though she started off great, that was the end of her career.
So talk a little bit about those controversies. You had the snitch scandal in the jail, right? The informants. And then you also had the mass murder at the hair salon, Scott Decry. She oversaw a sheriff's department that was in turmoil as well, right?
She saw a department that she thought was clean from everything that was in the Corona era and before that, but it turned out no. She says that she never knew that there were sheriff's deputies that were running the system of having informants who were procuring these illegal jailhouse confessions. And the person who found this out, of course, was public defender Scott Sanders he was defending Scott Decry, the biggest mass murderer in Orange County history, and what should have been a slam dunk case instead just completely fell off the rails, totally transformed Orange County law enforcement, led to the election loss of longtime district attorney Tony Rakakis. And Sandra, and it's interesting about her dying from breast cancer, because she never really, she never put it out there that much. People knew, but she wasn't broadcasting it out to the world. So it made sense at 2018, she wants to live the rest of her life pretty peacefully. But at the same time, she left under that cloud. And also the last year of her reign as Orange County Sheriff, you had this notorious jailhouse break. So she ended, it was controversy, also an embarrassment.
We established that she's a trailblazer, obviously, going in. Are there other women in law enforcement, Gustavo, who perhaps could follow in her footsteps?
The lesson that Sandra could give to women in law enforcement is, do your job, do it correctly, don't fall into the trappings of especially sheriff's departments. Sheriff's departments, and I've written about this in the LA Times, more so than police departments, sheriff's departments seem to be rife with corruption. Or in the case of her successor, Don Barnes, people who don't want to enforce COVID-19 mandates. And so, be better than male sheriffs who do not have the best of track records, especially in Southern California. But also, at least with Sandra, law enforcement has notoriously been a macho culture. Sandra was able to rise from the bottom all the way to the top. So following that, if she could do it, other people can, but do it better than her.
And we remember her after she passed away after the long battle with breast cancer. Gustavo Arellano from the LA Times. Thanks.
Gracias.
That's going to do it for us today. A reminder that tomorrow we'll have coverage of yet another vote for the impeachment of President Donald Trump in the United States House. As long as that takes, we'll be covering it tomorrow. Also, coverage of the inauguration a week from tomorrow. And a special request. Are you planning to attend that event in Washington, either to celebrate or to protest? Are you in fear of what could happen? We want to hear from you. KCRW.com/inauguration. And while you're at the website, subscribe to the podcast, too, and tell us how you're doing. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Paul Smith, Ray Guarna, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on the show. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for joining us this evening. Have a great night.